Well, we can start with a commonality question here. What do they have in common, Henry VIII and Robin Hood? And we come up with quite a cast of characters, and the answer would be forthcoming.
The answer would be merry and musical before Elizabeth. That's the title of the 11th Annual Madison Early Music Festival. That's the theme this year. And by the way, welcome to the Midday. I'm Stephanie.
I'm Norman.
I'm Norman. And we also have in the studio with us Tom Zajac. He's performed on historic winds and percussion as a member of many groups throughout the years. Pifero, Exumbris, the Waverly Consort, New York's Ensemble for Early Music. And Tom appears very frequently with the Folger Consort, King's Noise, Newbery Consort, and tonight with Hesperus here in Madison. He's played at the White House, on a Prairie Home Companion, for PBS, and the sound of his bagpipe awoke the astronauts every morning on a 2001 space shuttle mission.
Is there a story behind that?
It was not live, I can tell you.
He's on many, many CDs, too many to mention, but they range from medieval to 21st century chamber music. And we also have Paul Rowe, a very talented baritone and the artistic director of the Madison Early Music Festival. Paul is a professor of voice at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has performed with the Boston Symphony Orchestra at Carnegie Hall, the American Ballet Theater, the Folger Consort, and again, a very long list of ensembles all over the country and the world. And Paul has also made a number of recordings and will be performing this week at the Madison Early Music Festival. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks,
you. Stephanie.
Well, we also have another guest. We mentioned Tom's bagpipe waking up the astronauts. We have a couple of bagpipes here in the studio.
You've slumped into lunchtime lethargy. Well, this will take you right out of it.
That's right. Well, if the title of the, if the theme of the festival is music, merry and musical before Elizabeth. Well, we're certainly merry and musical here on the Midday.
Bagpipe actually started out in Italy, didn't it?
Well, they no one knows for sure, but it's possible that it started in Etruscan times in, on the Italian peninsula. There's one kind of stone carving of a bagpiper from who knows what BC, a really long time ago.
What's the reaction to the in stone to that bagpiper? Is there an audience, or is he out in a field by himself?
He looks pretty lonely.
Well, it's an instrument that has a variety of sizes and shapes and sounds.
Exactly. People tend to associate it with Scotland because that's the bagpipe that we know the best, the Highland bagpipe. But they're all over Europe still to this very day.
Well, we'll get to that in a little while. I have a question about a fairly prominent Renaissance composer, though. Actually, maybe a question about a lot of royal composers as to whether you think they really wrote their stuff. Do you think Henry VIII really wrote Pastime with Good Company?
Well, there's really not much way to determine that for sure. But it does exist in a manuscript that was dedicated to Henry, and so we know that he at least was involved in music. He was a trained musician. He was very well educated, obviously. And so it's possible he wrote the tune. It's possible he found the tune somewhere and arranged it. We really can't determine that.
It's a little suspicious how many pieces in the manuscript are attributed to him. I think it's sort of a case of royal prerogative. I like that piece. I think I wrote
it. My name on it. Yeah, it's a long tradition.
And well, with Henry, you didn't want to question him very much, I don't think.
Well, actually, that does, or worse, that does bring to mind Anne Boleyn.
And yes.
Actually, she has some pieces attributed to her, too, doesn't
true,
she?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One beautiful song.
Not a very happy song, but it's pretty.
The Madison Early Music Festival kicked off last Saturday, and it's going all week through next Saturday. And the piece, Norman, that you just mentioned will be performed on Thursday night as all of these professionals get together and do a joint concert. It's just a magical night in Madison.
Well, here's what it sounds like in the hands of the New World Renaissance Band, Pastime with Good Company, attributed to, and who's going to argue, Henry VIII.
Thank you.
that was their fate, not mine. I hasten to exculpate myself there. What is it that makes it sound, that early Renaissance music sound like contemporary Middle Eastern music? I mean, was there, did it all sound much the same way back then and then kind of split off for a few hundred years?
To answer the second question first, each country had its own regional sound. The international style didn't really take place until the beginning of the 15th century, where French were learning from the Italians and the Italians were learning from the French, and the English composers came over to the continent, and you can imagine they had jam sessions where they taught each other their own styles. So one of the things you can say about Renaissance music is it really is sort of an international style where everything got mixed together and maybe became more streamlined and simplified.
And Henry VIII, you say, really liked it kind of on the simple side?
Well, he liked all kinds of. I think he was pretty sophisticated, actually, musically. And in the book that's dedicated to him, there's French music and a lot of different styles. It's very eclectic, the choice of material in there. And surprising.
Actually, there's a few pieces in the manuscript that are some of the most difficult music written in its time.
By Henry, attributed to Henry VIII.
No, he I think he was wise enough to leave those
claim to be able to write that music. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Cornish and Fairfax, a couple other composers.
Tonight is a pretty interesting program. It's entitled Early Music and Silent Film. What is that about, Tom?
Yeah, well, it's sort of a new thing, and Tina Chansey, the director of Hesperus, I think is the first one to try it with early music, although there's been a movement of musicians adding music to silent film for a while now. There's a group based in Boston called Allied Orchestra, which happens to be just three people, but it's a nice name. And they've been doing stuff like Metropolis and some Buster Keaton films. But Tina found this 1923, I think, is the date. It's with
Douglas Fairbanks.
Douglas Fairbanks,
right.
Sr.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yes, it was quite the stuntman.
Yeah, it's a delightful movie. And it takes place, you know, it's sort of the classic story of Robin Hood and Maid Marian, and it just fits perfectly with the music. And I think it was sort of a stroke of genius on her part to see that possibility.
So they're not using, I mean, are they using the music that was used in 1923, or they're saying we're doing totally things that would sound like Robin Hood's time?
Right. I mean, they didn't know anything about the music of Henry VIII's period in 1923. They probably had, melodramatic piano music in the background.
Or an organ.
Sometimes
theaters had giant theatrical organs.
Much like the one in Madison, Wisconsin, the Grand Barton organ.
Sure. That's right. Yeah.
Tom, you're playing with Hesperus tonight. You'll be playing with the big ensemble on Thursday and then again on Saturday. But you've also spent quite a lot of time with Pifaro.
Yes.
And you have a brand new CD hot off the press.
We do.
What's the opening piece on that CD?
It's a piece by Thomas Wilkes, I think. It's called Tan Taran Tan, and it's sort of a fanfare-like piece. It has words, but we play it as much as Pifaro does quite often. We play vocal music instrumentally, and this is on two treble shawms, which are very loud and piercing predecessors of the oboe.
No, they're not that bad. I've heard this.
And the trombone.
They're no bagpipes.
No bagpipes. No.
Yet.
Not so piercing.
No, lovely shawm playing. That was Pifaro from their brand new CD called Waits, English Music for a Renaissance Band, and that piece was by Thomas Wilkes, Tantara Rantara Cries Mars.
Very well said.
Well, the week of performing is pretty grueling, but it's not just about performances. There are lots of classes and lectures. We were just talking then about the legend of Robin Hood, which is really a kind of a fictional construct.
Right. It's one of those myths that has a long history. It's confusing. No one can really identify a historical Robin Hood. There was no guy in Sherwood Forest. And a lot of our images, it's really interesting to have the movie from the 20s, because our images of Robin Hood are mostly Hollywood.
Men in tights.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think Mel Brooks got it right. So.
But there was a Robin and Mary in literature in the Middle Ages in France, like in the 12th and 13th century, and they were just peasants and kind of country bumpkins, and that Robin was kind of a galumphing dandy who thought he was a pretty fancy dancer but was actually sort of a dolt, and Marion always kind of saved his ass. And can I say that?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question. It sounds like it got a hold of a good PR guy somewhere along the line and kind of polished up the image there.
Well, the other thing that has come up a lot in the sort of getting ready for this week and all that is the legend of Tristan, which is also part of this. And it's another Tristan and Isolde, which we always think of as a Wagner story, but really it's a medieval story that it's a legend that gives you lovers and, you know, it sets up a whole storyline that you can sort of freeform on the basic pattern. And that seems to be what people are looking for, is stereotypes, and then you can feed off the stereotype.
Well, there are certainly all kinds of currents of culture. I think of, in the Renaissance, I think of John Dowland, or Doland, I guess as it's sometimes said, and the difficulty that he had as a relatively staid Englishman when he went up to the Danish court, and everybody was, what shall we say, party animals. And
he had a sad life.
Yeah. He had trouble everywhere he went. He was always a misfit, it seems like. A Catholic in a Protestant country. And
yeah, he was like one of the Peanuts characters with the rain cloud over him. And his music reflects that, doesn't it?
Definitely.
In fact, one called Semper Dowland, Semper Dowland.
Right.
By the way. Always grieving, always Dowland.
Yeah.
Tom, why don't you blow up your bagpipes and play us a little tune?
I brought a couple. These are replicas of Renaissance bagpipes. None of them really exist, so the makers of these are looking at iconography that show bagpipes and kind of deducing what a bagpipe would be like based on that.
Now, I know there are lots of cross currents that happen at these festivals. I wonder how much you can work the bagpipe into some of these ensembles.
Well, there's no written music that survives for a bagpipe from medieval or Renaissance period, so you have to kind of create stuff based on dance music that does survive and kind of deconstruct from the written sources. And that's basically how we do it. But it's fun finding it's like doing detective work to find repertory that'll work on the bagpipe.
And who's going to dispute it? Let's face it. They're not going to say, I was there and I know that it wasn't played like that.
Well, Thomas.
Yeah, the bagpipe has some interesting things with it. I mean, it has a drone, right? And so that's part of the setup of it. And also the way that this bagpipe is different from the Highland pipe, it's just a bag that you press on, you fill with air, and then so it's an interesting thing to play. I think it's simpler in some ways than the Highland pipes.
Yes, only one drone instead of the three drones of the Highland bagpipe.
But you have these finger holes, obviously.
Right. There's actually three pipes in even the most simple bagpipe. There's the chanter pipe, which has a reed, and you have finger holes like a flute or a recorder. So you can play a melody on that. And then there's the drone, which sticks up sometimes over the shoulder, sometimes straight out, which just plays one note. And that provides like a bed for the melody to lay upon.
It's your basso continuo.
Yeah, of one note.
Of one note, yeah.
And then there's the blowpipe. And that's the pipe that allows the player to introduce air into the bag. And it has a little valve at the end, which keeps the air from coming back out at the player. And when the bag is completely full, it acts like an extra set of lungs. So you can keep the air flowing through the pipes by catching breaths and squeezing the bag to keep the air pressure constant.
But if you don't play it, do you lose your investment in what you've blown into there? I mean, if you blow air into the bag and then talk as you're doing now, did you just lose everything?
So he lost
all the
air he blew. Right.
It leaks out.
Yeah, and you can, as long as you're squeezing with the arm, you can keep the air going, but you can only do that for so long before you have to reintroduce air.
Wow,
So we'll have to let him blow up the pipe, and then Well, what are you going to play for us?
I'll play a little bit of a ditty called La Brunette.
La Brunette. I like that.
As opposed to La Blonde.
That's an exciting sequel.
Or La Russe.
That was La Brunette.
Downright lovely. Tom Zajac with one of his bagpipes.
And there goes the air.
I can hear the air leaking out.
That's the bell buzzing. I don't know if the audience...
It always sounds so sad when you stop playing it, doesn't it?
There's also quite a lot of vocal music on the program this week.
Well, vocal music was very important, and a lot of the musical forms are actually based on poetic forms. So there's really a symbiosis kind of between the words and the music. And much of the music would be printed with words, but then sometimes played just by instruments. And we don't really know how they balance that out, or, you know, there's no way to really tell how they would have done it. But it seems to be the practice that... that's where a lot of, like, Pifaro's programs are. There are texts to some of that music, but they just play it as instrumental. You know, it's...
Which, presumably, was done in all kinds of different ways originally.
It's still being done, you know, now.
There's an ensemble performing tomorrow night called Liber, and their program is Fly Leaves, Medieval Music from English Manuscripts, which sounds fascinating, resurrecting hidden treasures from medieval England.
Is there going to be passing or changing of instruments during performances, as you sometimes hear about in early music? I mean, if we see you on stage, are we going to see you in the middle of a...
No, that's very unsanitary. We try not to do that.
Well, I didn't mean from one player to the next, I meant. But we see a given player, like, put down the little one and pick up the medium-sized one during a performance.
Tonight. Yeah. Definitely. It hasn't happened with the string instruments. That doesn't happen as much. It seems that, you know, once you're... Because also tuning is an issue, and everybody has gut strings. So we on Friday night, we did an outdoor concert at Bill Wortman's estate in Edgerton. And it was the... And King's Noise played. So they have all this violin band. And it got more humid as the evening fell. And so their strings got heavier, and it got harder to play. And then they did a similar concert last night in Mills. And if you've ever been to a concert in Mills, you know it gets colder and colder as the concert goes on. So they had the exact opposite. Everything dried out. So it was kind of interesting to talk to them after about the different versions of the concert they had.
You have to come to the dry version and the wet version.
That's right.
But musicians in the Renaissance were expected to be able to play a number of different instruments and be very flexible, you know, sometimes playing for church services on feast days, sometimes playing on the steps in front of the church after services, playing from the watchtower to announce the hours.
That's
playing
called
for dances.
Job security.
Exactly. Dance music, sacred music, really just an all-purpose musician. I mean, it was a craft, and there were guilds. It was an artisan, I mean, thought of as a...
Definitely.
Sort of thing.
And all the way to, you know, being the personal musician of some rich person or royalty, mm-hmm. where you would play in the evening because they didn't have stereos or radios. So you would hire a lutenist to sit in your bedchamber and play while you go to sleep.
And the top musicians were paid like rock stars. They really got handsome salaries for their work.
Yes, I'm told some of them made more than cabinet ministers, you know, for example. And I suppose there would be a reason for that, too.
Just like basketball players.
Mm-hmm.
The finale of the concert is Saturday night, and that's a program called O Western Wind, polyphonic music of the Tudors. And that Western Wind...
It's a familiar tune. It was actually a popular tune that John Taverner used as the foundation for a mass. And we're going to do two movements of that Western Wind mass.
It has spectacularly surprising words, doesn't it, for a mass? at least the one version I know of it. Oh, western wind, wind wilt thou blow, the small rain down can rain. Christ,
right.
Were my lover in my arms and I in my bed again. I mean, that's the subject
right,
for a
exactly.
mass.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, that's pretty graphic romance, actually.
It was fairly typical, actually, to use secular tunes, sometimes with rather direct lyrics in the context of
well,
services.
You know, bring people into church. They're still doing that sort of thing today, too. Well, it's going to be quite the gala week.
Yes, it will. We're talking about the Madison Early Music Festival. It's the 11th annual festival with world-class recording ensembles and musicians in to Wisconsin, to Madison for these performances. Two of them are already passed, but there is a performance tonight featuring Hesperus. Tomorrow night is Lieber. Thursday night is all of these wonderful professional faculty together on the stage at one time for a program called England Be Glad. And then Friday night is Benjamin Bagby doing the Beowulf. We haven't even talked about that.
In old English, accompanying himself on a six-string harp.
If you have any opportunity to see this, don't miss it. It's an incredible thing.
Is he doing all three monsters, do you know? Doing the whole thing?
Yeah,
it's just him and a harp, and he just sits in the middle
plays,
of the stage.
It's very dramatic. He does different voices, and
it's
mesmerizing. Theatrical. Yeah.
You won't find that just anywhere.
And then as a follow-up to that, Beowulf, we're also doing a roundtable discussion on Saturday afternoon, which is something we haven't tried before, but this subject has sparked so much interest. And I know Norman has been interested in Beowulf for a long time, and so he's actually going to be the moderator of this roundtable discussion. It'll be in Morphy Hall at 1:30 on Saturday.
That's on the campus at UW-Madison.
Right, with Ben Bagby. Who's doing the performance on Friday night, and he's done a lot of study about reconstructing how this piece may have been transmitted and performed. And also with Professor John Niles of UW. He's actually a humanities professor in the English department, and his specialty is early English and Beowulf. So it should be a great discussion.
It's a multimedia a week. And all of these performances have lectures beforehand, so you get a feel for the context of the music.
At 6:30 before each concert.
And each concert starts at 7:30. You can find more information at arts.wisc.edu, or tickets can be ordered at 608-265-ARTS. That's the Madison Early Music Festival. Our guests have been Tom Zajac, who will be performing tonight with that early music and silent film program, the Robin Hood Project, live early music along with the projection of this Douglas Fairbanks
Bring
film.
Bring your own popcorn.
And Paul Rowe, who is also performing this week, and he's the artistic director of the Madison Early Music Festival.